The Tom Woods Show, episode 1566.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Get ready for Contra Cruise 2020. This is the fifth cruise economist Bob Murphy and I have hosted together, and it is always a blast. And this year will be no different. Scott Horton and Dave Smith are joining us as special guests. Can you imagine spending a week having a blast with these guys on board a beautiful ship with a bunch of like-minded folks? It's going to be fantastic. Check it out at ContraCruise.com. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. All right, we're talking about Donald Trump today on Jeff Deist Week. Jeff, remember, is president of the Mises Institute, which you can check out at Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org. I highly recommend. And former chief of staff to Ron Paul. As a matter of fact, the very last chief of staff to Ron Paul. We're going to talk about Donald Trump today, because why not, right? Pretty big topic. Jeff, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. It is great to talk to you again.
All right. We're talking about Donald Trump today. Figure might as well. Got to say something about him. And I have not talked that much about him. I'm looking in my list of episodes. I have not talked that much about him. And some people have been upset about that, that I should be criticizing him more. But then I look back and I didn't talk about Obama either. Because, it's idiosyncratic. It's called the Tom Woods Show. It's whatever interests me. And I generally just, if it's something everybody's talking about, then it just bores me. Like, everybody's talking about Obamacare. Like, I don't want to talk about, you know, so I would have perfunctory episodes on Obamacare, but I just hated every minute of it. So I don't know why that is. But when he did the Afghanistan strike, I had Scott Horton on, and we've been critical of him on foreign policy from time to time. But I don't know. But sometimes I want to talk about what he means, what he stands for, what he represents, really, because in a way, he's almost not bright enough to fully appreciate what he represents. I mean, he almost sort of gets it, but not fully really. So that kind of interests me, because I'm just interested in the world of ideas. I'm not interested in his daily peccadilloes. That just doesn't do anything for me. But the Trump phenomenon, the fact that the electorate went for a guy everybody told them not to go for, now that is interesting to me. That actually is interesting to me. But when I look over his record, okay, there's definitely some stuff on the economy that is pretty good, but there's some other stuff on the economy that's hopeless. And it really is the case. It's not just a dopey libertarian take on it to say that he really, really has confusion about trade. He does. That's a fact. He really does have confusion about trade. And when it comes to the Fed, he's confused, or he wants interest rates even lower and this and that. So we have all that stuff. We have the appointments. My gosh, I mean, yeah, we cheered because he got rid of John Bolton. That's because he hired John Bolton. You know, what is the problem? Why would you want Mike Pompeo? Why would you care so little for your professed ideas that you wouldn't even look into who the natural people you should appoint to help carry them out would be? You know, so and now with what's going on in Iraq and Iran, and he's just got done saying, he had this big long series of tweets, we got to get out of these wars and this and that. And now who knows what the future holds? I don't know. I mean, what do you say about him? What do you say about him, Jeff Deist? And by the way, at the same time, and I'm just setting the stage for our conversation, at the same time, I do think it is a problem when people portray him as a unique evil in American history. There are even some libertarians who, for heaven's sake, unless they know no history whatsoever, should be ashamed of themselves for falling into that particular trap. This is the opportunity for libertarians to point out, look, it's the whole regime that's the problem. I was telling people this during the Obama years. I was telling Tea Party people this, that listen, repeat after me. If the successor of Barack Obama, who happens to be a Republican, winds up doing the same things this guy did, I will also be upset at those. You know, I did that exercise with some Tea Party groups, you know, to say that I'm sick and tired of you telling me this is a unique evil. And then you turn around and there's another party doing the same thing, and suddenly you're standing up and saluting. You know, like, we should be talking about the whole regime is the problem. It's not like, well, if only we get rid of Trump, things would be a lot better because we'd have the American establishment back in the saddle again. And heaven knows we need Henry Kissinger and Joe Lieberman and John Kerry and the ghost of John McCain. We need those people in charge because they've really done such a good job for us. How could a libertarian think that way? I just don't understand. I do understand how you could say, I don't like Trump at all. I don't understand how you could say he's a uniquely wicked person. Really? Do you know anything about Woodrow Wilson? Do you know anything about FDR? Do you know anything about Harry Truman? I mean, on and on and on. It's ridiculous. And when you point this out, you get accused of, that's whataboutism. You always bring up whataboutism. What about FDR? Well, yeah. Yeah, that's what you have to do when you have a bunch of people who have occupied the same office. You have to compare them. And if you're going to tell me that this guy is the worst one ever or is some kind of unique evil, then yeah, I have to say, if you're going to use the word unique, you better look that up in the dictionary. Because for all Trump's faults, he's not Woodrow Wilson. He's not FDR. So don't – I just can't get over libertarians who are – they're just so thirsting for mainstream respectability. They want to raise their hands in the back of the class and say, I'm also against Trump, everybody. Hey, Mr. New York Times reporter, sir, did you see I'm against Trump? You know, oh, come on. Are we reduced to this?
We are, Tom. We are absolutely reduced to
we are. It was a rhetorical question.
The thing about Trump is he may have gone around the bend last week with his strike on an Iranian general in Iraq. If this ultimately leads to an escalation of things with Iran and an actual war with Iran, then of course everything is going to be very, very different in our assessment of him. That will be absolutely, wholly, totally unforgivable. And especially given what we already know about our endless entanglements in Iraq and Afghanistan and where they've led to. And Iran is not Iraq or Afghanistan. Iran is something like 80 million people. It has a real army. It doesn't have much of a Navy or an Air Force, but it has a real army. And so this is no joke. There are U.S. interests and soldiers up and down the Persian Gulf that Iran could touch. So this is no joke. It's an unfolding situation. And of course, one in which he might have horribly bungled despite having gotten rid of Bolton. I mean, it's just, it's hard to fathom. But I think, here's my take on Trump. First of all, I think he is a man who is uniquely susceptible to flattery. I think he likes listening to praise. And if people around him are able to skillfully manipulate that, he can probably be talked into things because he has sort of a fighter's instinct. He likes to punch and counterpunch, but he doesn't have much in the way of ideological moorings. And why would he? I mean, what in his past would make you think that? And I'll play armchair psychologist for a second. He is old enough. Certainly his father was old enough to have come from an era where, you know, Manhattan was really different from the rest of New York City, and Manhattanites sort of looked down on the other boroughs. And so I think his father and then Trump himself have craved respectability from the Manhattan establishment as he came up through the ranks, or they came up through the ranks in real estate development, and that they would never really be accepted. They would always be outsiders in what, at least in Trump's father's day, was still sort of an old money system in New York. And so I think that may have affected him growing up, this sort of need to brag and to inflate himself and to win at everything and to lack any sense of grace, which is the big one in Penn and Teller. Oh my gosh, I can't recall.
Oh, Penn.
Penn, yes, the big one. He was on Trump's reality show, The Apprentice. And I saw, I think, a segment with him. It might have been on the Joe Rogan show or somewhere else, where he basically said, you know, when you're around Trump in person, off camera, this is a really joyless man. He apparently doesn't laugh. He just doesn't have the ability to laugh unless it's some sort of mocking, derisive laugh, and you know, like laughing at someone in a nasty way. And Penn also said that he doesn't listen to music. You know, this is not a guy who would turn on some music, you know, and enjoy it. So he's a very strange cat and really, really different. So, but I mean, there's been plenty of strange cats in the Oval Office. So, I mean, Richard Nixon was a very strange cat in many ways. But, you know, when I think about Trump, I like to go back. I think this was something I argued on the Contra Cruise a couple of years ago. Imagine Donald Trump didn't exist. And imagine it was towards the end of Barack Obama's term, and you went to the Democrats, you went to the left and said, look, guys, after Obama, I got some bad news for you. The next president is not going to be Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden or whatever. The next president is going to be Republican. I'm sorry, but I have a crystal ball, and I'm telling you the next president's a Republican. But good news, it's not some red state governor, like the, you know, the aforementioned Mike Huckabee or whatever. It's not, you know, it's actually a sophisticated New York City developer. And not only is it a sophisticated New York City developer, you know, it's a guy who has had a series of trophy wives and has a really beautiful and stylish and chic wife from Eastern Europe who speaks a bunch of different languages. And in the course of this hypothetical person's career, they have been in and around New York circles their whole life. They're quite a wealthy person, allegedly a billionaire. We don't know that. This person is very comfortable with and has rubbed shoulders with all kinds of folks from different walks of life, gay and lesbian folks, Jewish folks, Black folks, is well regarded in the African American community, is actually lauded by people like Al Sharpton. This person is not animated by social issues like abortion or prayer. This person is absolutely not a Christian conservative in any way. This person actually is quite favorable towards unions and advocates trade protectionism. And some of our listeners might recall that back in the dark ages before Trump, Democrats liked tariffs. So, you know, if you put all that in a blender and said, look, okay, if that's the next president and it has to be a Republican, and gee, that at least sounds like a Republican we'd take. So all of this hysteria over Trump is all about tone and style. It's not about substance. You know, as you said, he's not a unique evil. He's no more or less fascist than some of his more immediate predecessors like Obama and W. I mean, you know, this idea that fascism is just some generic term we use for anything we don't like. Fascism means, first and foremost, an authoritarian ruler. Second, a melding of corporate and state power. Third, a suspension or dilution of liberties, you know, suppressions of press, putting people in jail, that sort of thing. You know, these are the basic elements of fascism. And if you look at it that way, is Trump more or less fascist? You know, okay. I don't know. I think this was the left's reaction to Hillary not winning. I mean, in other words, there are things that are just very difficult for people to overcome psychologically. We all have this. And so in our personal lives, when you know, certain memories or certain things in our past are difficult, we have a psychological coping mechanism whereby we create a narrative in our head that explains it in a way that we can live with better, that makes us more at ease with an uncomfortable situation. I think that's basically what happened when Hillary didn't win. So many people's worldviews about this sort of arc of progressive social democracy that was just unstoppable and that was inevitable, when that didn't happen, and of course, Brexit was a precursor to this, by the way, when it didn't happen, people had to come up with a reason for this. And the reasons are that, you know, America is this deeply retrograde and racist country. Trump colluded with the Russians to have $150,000 worth of Facebook ads, and dummy Americans actually changed their votes. Because if that's true, by the way, if this Facebook ad buying thing is true, that's a strong argument against Democratic voting. If people are that weak that they look at a Facebook ad, my God.
Yeah.
So I think these were psychological coping mechanisms to deal with the fact that Trump won. And it was, from a libertarian perspective, it was never about Trump. It was never about his policies, so-called. It was never about his cabinets or who he'd appoint or any of this stuff. It was about the simple fact that that many people were willing to go off the reservation, 60, 70 million people, and vote for this unknown in the face of what seemed to be just an absolute lock by Hillary Clinton. So look, the guy kneecapped the Bush and Clinton crime families in one election. He sent Jeb Bush away looking like some sort of bedraggled puppy dog. I mean, this is a big deal. This is a big deal. I'm not sure America goes back to how it was before. And social media plays a role. This is not just Trump. But shouldn't libertarians look at that, at least back in 2016 when it happened, with some degree of optimism and say, wait a minute, if that many people could sort of shift gears, then there's some hope in that. And I think that's true. I think that's still true. You know, go back to 1992, Ross Perot, third party candidate. Okay, Ross Perot got 19 million votes. People forget about that. That was about 20% of the voting electorate. He got 19 million votes. And then in the next election, everyone just went back to the R's and the D's. Nothing changed. So what we have to understand is Trump won as a third party. A third party candidate won. And libertarians take no cheer or heart from this? I mean, that's crazy. A third-party candidate won. This is a guy who had no friends within the GOP establishment. He spent something like a third of what Hillary Clinton spent. So forget campaign finance reform. Trump winning absolutely blew all arguments for that out the door. For anybody who brings up Citizens United ever again in the federal context is just a moron. He had no ground game. He had no GOP precinct chairs, none of that state by state, precinct by precinct, you know, ground game that a Jeb Bush would have had or a Mitt Romney had or whatever. And he still won. I mean, he basically won as a third party candidate. Now, I understand he had an R next to his name, which brings a certain cohort of just, you know, moronic automatons vote for you. I understand that gives you ballot access very easily. I get that. But in essence, Tom, he won as a third party candidate. And so you got to look at that as a lot of people are really fed up. And so that can go in a bad, scary, nationalist, fascist direction, or that could go in a good direction for liberty. But if you can't even acknowledge, if you got to say, oh, my gosh, you know, Trump is so much worse than Hillary. A lot of libertarians not only would have preferred Hillary to Trump. I think a lot of D.C. libertarians in particular would have much preferred this sort of technocratic left of center elite person to Trump. I think a lot of them would prefer Hillary to Ron Paul. I mean, honestly. So, you know, it was really something. And some days I honestly still can't believe he won. I mean, I still wake up and I see what this guy is tweeting. And I think, oh my God. So I'm old enough to have grown up in a world where, you know, Walter Mondale and such, and this was just unthinkable. So I think 25-year-olds just think this is how it is. And so, you know, what does this mean for liberty going forward? I think more than anything, I hope it means that there are some cracks in the foundation of U.S. hegemony and U.S. foreign policy, because neoconservatism is going to be the death of us. It's going to be the death of us overseas. We're going to create enemies to the end of time. And it's going to be the death of us domestically, because we're going to add $1 trillion, $1.5 trillion, $2 trillion every year until, you know, good luck getting your Social Security. So I've always thought that fiscal conservative known as George W. Bush, if he had gone to the American people back in 01, 02, when he was making the case to basically reignite his father's war against Saddam Hussein, if he had said, look, we all agree, we got to fight him over there so we don't fight him over here. We have, you know, Saddam Hussein had yellow cake uranium. He was harboring terrorists. He has weapons of mass destruction. Clearly, we have to go get rid of Saddam Hussein. We're all in agreement, right, that this is the right thing to do. And because I'm a conservative, we're going to pay as we go. And every household is going to be assessed an additional $500 per month that you have to send in until Saddam's out of there. Can you? I mean, the Iraq War would never have happened. I mean, it would have been an absolute non-starter. But that's not, of course, how we fund foreign wars. And so I really hope that if nothing else, Trump means that there's some glimmers of hope on the foreign policy side of things, which affects so much at home.
All right, let's take a quick break. Come right back. If you're like me, you're going into 2020 thinking about all the stuff you didn't get to in 2019 and your real genuine goals for the new year. Well, if you want to work toward being your best self in 2020 and understand the world around you, in addition to listening to The Tom Woods Show, and you want to make sure your time is well spent, then Blinkist is for you. Blinkist is for anybody who cares about learning but doesn't have a lot of time. It takes the key insights from over 3,000 nonfiction bestsellers in over 27 categories, condenses them down into 15-minute blinks, which are text and audio explainers that help you understand more about the core ideas of each book. I like Blinkist because, frankly, I don't like fluff, and a lot of books are full of it. This way, I can get exactly what I need to know with the least investment of time. Of course, I use it when I'm driving around, which I do a lot with five daughters. So on my way home, I want to make sure that I make good use of the time, and I can get a book or two under my belt on just the simplest drive. Recently, I've listened to these books, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, and Start With Why, How Great Leaders Inspire Everyone to Take Action. You can join the 12 million people already enjoying Blinkist today with a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your free 7-day trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/woods. Jeff, I seem to recall you saying something along the lines of, and you know what, maybe it wasn't you, but somebody said it, let's talk about it, that when you think back to how Trump campaigned, he focused on three or four issues. It was trade, it was immigration, and, you know, one or two other things, political correctness or whatever. But if you asked him about something like farm policy, he'd give you an answer. But that wasn't what he was stumping around talking about. He's just stayed focused on his main core issues. And so at least whether you liked him or you didn't like him, you knew what he was about. He's about these things. So it's kind of like when Howard Stern ran for governor of New York. It was three things. It was bring back the death penalty. It was had to do with the tolls. And it was do road work at night so as not to cause so much traffic. I mean, that was it. I mean, he had no ambition to remake your life or to get himself into every nook and cranny of society. He had a few basic things, so everybody knew where he stood. And I'm pretty sure I've heard you say that if a libertarian were really to make a serious go at the presidency, that should be the model, not trying to give the libertarian policy report answer on every single thing under the sun, but try and pick three or four things that are deeply unpopular in the country and just hammer away at them. Now, first of all, am I remembering this correctly? And secondly, if you could advise such a person, what would you have them hammer home?
Well, Ron Paul did that. He hammered home a couple things. Get out of the Middle East. Just repeat that until the cows come home. And use some graphs, use some charts, use some math to show that we're not going to be able to pay entitlements much longer if we keep maintaining this level of deficit spending, and that at some point, all the debt we're amassing is going to, you know, make our foreign buyers of U.S. Treasury debt very nervous, and they're going to start demanding junk bond interest rates, which we can't pay. And so I think you would just talk about get out of the Middle East. There's a natural constituency, basically the whole country outside of Washington, D.C., and a few suburbs in Northern Virginia and Maryland wants to get us out of the Middle East. I mean, everyone is sick of it, the people in the reserves. So you've got a huge natural constituency for a repeated hardcore message about getting out of the Middle East. And you have a smaller but nonetheless extant constituency for end the Fed. And Ron said this time and time again, and I know some libertarians think, oh, that's no one cares about that, nobody understands it. But yeah, well, that's true. Most people don't understand the Fed. As a matter of fact, that's no crime. Most economists don't understand the Fed. In fact, most monetary economists barely understand anything about actual Fed mechanics. So it's no crime, but you know, there's nothing wrong with being populist when the underlying message happens to be right. And getting rid of the Fed is the right message from a libertarian perspective. So while people don't understand it, they do smell a rat. They do sense that something's amiss, that the Federal Reserve system creates sort of an undeserving class of rich people who are in and around Wall Street, who are a little closer to the money spigot, which is all true, by the way. And so it's a great populist message. So I think whoever is a candidate, whether that's Tulsi or Jacob Hornberger or whoever it might be, you know, I would be out there talking about war and peace and getting rid of this central banking system, which works to the benefit of a tiny, wealthy portion of society while making all kinds of mischief and, you know, phony entitlement spending and war spending possible. So it's the great enabler of everything bad Congress does. So, those would be my big populist issues. And, you know, maybe there's others, maybe I'm wrong, but I'll tell you what, keeping it simple, there's nothing wrong with that. A couple shows ago, we mentioned Nigel Farage just talked about Brexit, you know, and within the scope of Brexit, if you were for Brexit, that's all he cared about. He didn't say, oh, but by the way, you know, I'm a conservative, so we got to reduce pensions. Or he didn't say, oh, you know, we got to reform the National Health Service in Britain. And by the way, in doing so, we're going to have to cut a bunch of doctors. You know, he didn't wander into any other areas of politics where he might find people disagree with him. So it's a bit of an apples and oranges comparison because the UK is a parliamentary system with minor parties. But, you know, at this point, if Trump won, I mean, look, if Trump won, anybody can win. You know, Dwayne Johnson, The Rock might be the next president. Tulsi might be the next president. I don't know. But, you know, there's a constituency for peace that straddles these two intractable parties. And that's where I think we kicked the door down. And if you want to call that America first, if you want to call that isolationism, I don't care. You know, it, like Scott Horton says, talk to the right from the right, talk to the left from the left. So it's interesting times, but you know, people don't want a smooth talking Pete Buttigieg technocratic approach. You know, I don't think that's what's going to carry the day in 2020. So let's just hope that whoever does carry the day is at least influenced somewhat by anti-war efforts, whether those be libertarian or otherwise.
Do you think after Trump, whether the after Trump comes in 2020 or 2024, the Republican Party just goes back to Romney McCain? Can they do that? Is that what they're going to try to do? Has Trump, I mean, you're right, he had a lot of success outside the official precincts of the Republican Party. But if he wants to leave a lasting imprint on that party, he's got to dig his nails deep into those official precincts. And I don't know if he's done that or not. So do you have any instinct about that? What happens after Trump? Do they act like this was just an aberration? We act like it never happened?
Well, they certainly can. I think the GOP is done nationally. I think within 5 or 10 years, Texas and Florida are permanent blue. So, you know, you're not going to be able to win national elections when New York, California, Texas, and Florida are all blue. It doesn't really matter what Ohio or Pennsylvania do at that point. So I think the GOP is done very soon nationally. And I think that if they were a better GOP, if they had more instincts of the old right, which you and I admire, they would focus on being a state and local party and, you know, see what they could do that way. But they won't do that because there's too much of a gravy train within Conservatism, Inc., within all these people like Mitt Romney. So they can't help themselves. I mean, you know, they're not going to change their stripes at this point. So I think it's a permanent minority party soon. And that's another thing, you know, for which we owe some debt of gratitude to Trump. I mean, he put the final knife in the back of the GOP and maybe hasten their demise. And, you know, people say, well, Jeff, that's bad because the Democrats are going to vote more left. Yeah, I get that. But all that's going to happen is that there'll be a realignment. I mean, there will be a left and right wing of the Democratic Party. And those are, I mean, the right wing of the Democratic Party today, is that Joe Biden? I don't know, is scarcely discernible from my perspective from Mitt Romney or whatever. I don't care. What do I care if conservatives and Republicans just sort of reform themselves in one end of the Democratic Party? And so you have a more right Democratic Party wins elections in Iowa or something, a more left Democratic Party wins them in California. That's not something I get particularly exercised over. But, you know, the Republican Party deserves to die. Let's face it. They screwed the pooch. And they gave up their birthright. They have no claim whatsoever to any mantle of limited government or constitutionalism or judiciousness or God or anything. I mean, this is just an absolute farce of a party. And if they had spent, you know, all that money that's poured into supposedly pro-life candidates who are mostly GOP over the last 3 decades, if all that money, these clowns, I mean, if all that money had just gone into actually helping young girls in trouble, could you imagine? You could have huge hospitals, delivery hospitals or something for a fraction of the money people who have probably spent on pro-life politics.
By the way, for that matter, obviously influencing young minds is, you know, one of the most significant things you can do, because by the time you get to a certain age, you tend to be set in your ways. So think of all the money that was spent on conservative politics that was wasted. How many victories do they have? They have almost none to point to. What if 1/1,000th of that money had been poured into creating a K-12 homeschool curriculum like the Ron Paul curriculum? It never occurred to any of them to do that. Instead, they'd rather blow the money on whatever, political consultants. But this practically would have made your lives better, and yet they can't help themselves.
Well, it's true. And over the years, they never bought a major studio. They kind of bought Fox News, but they never really, they just don't affect culture in any meaningful way. And they have some outposts like Hillsdale, which is still funded by conservative donors along with tuition. But this is a party that has lost its way and doesn't have anything to appeal to young people. I mean, the Democrats are really evil. Don't get me wrong. They are not well-intentioned. That's another terrible thing about dopey libertarians, is they sort of buy into this idea that the right is evil and the left is just misguided. Yeah, that's nonsense. What about the history of the 20th century makes you think the left is simply misguided but well-intentioned? I mean, come on. But nonetheless, the left can at least offer some things to young people, and that's why I think young people are moving left, and that's a failure of libertarianism. There's no question about it. We've failed in the sense that a lot of young people feel hopeless. They feel like they don't have much of a future. They feel like simple things, home ownership, marriage, children might be beyond them financially. And as a result, you know, people who don't feel like they have much skin in the game or as much to lose are more likely to vote for radical left policies or support them. So that's where we ought to be. We ought to be in there offering the radical alternative to that, because the GOP is off in a corner somewhere bumping into things. I mean, they're not in the picture as far as I'm concerned.
I more or less see things the way you do. And I don't know, there is still part of me, even after, it's like I'm an abuse victim. You get abused and you make excuses for your abuser. Well, you know, the abuser really loves me. You know, it's just a funny way of showing it, that kind of thing. There is still a part of me that thinks, yeah, the Republicans are terrible and I've spent years and years doing nothing but denouncing them. But, you know, at least the Democrats can't stand the sight of me. That's the difference. You know, so at least these people maybe hold them back a little while normal civil society tries to reassert itself. I mean, I don't know. But whether that's true or not, I think what you're saying is probably correct about the fate of the Republican Party. And it's interesting that it comes about as a result of demographics, because the Republican Party, you know, whether it's libertarian or not, could have tried to stop that and instead cheered it. And now it means there's not going to be any more Republican Party. It's just a very weird, thing, you know, that you would actively do something that in your heart of hearts, you know, means you're doomed, and yet you still do it. It's just a weird thing to me.
Yeah, and the idea that there's a libertarian wing of the GOP, I think, is mostly disabused by the fact that they had a couple of chances. They had three chances to vote for either Ron or Rand Paul in Republican primaries in some of those early states in 8 and 12 and 16, and they didn't. I mean, that's just a fact. So I don't carry any water for Republicans and never been one. And at this point, if they're not useful opposition to the left's march through the 20th century, then I'd rather just get it over with and come up with something new.
Well, let's see what, in fact, what they wind up coming up with. TomWoods.com/1566 is the show notes page. I do have a related episode that I'm going to post there that I did years ago with Roger McCaffrey on Trump and the political consultant. Because these are people who you have to pay them five figures a month, and they're going to tell you what to do and say and whatever. And the Trump phenomenon kind of blows that up a bit, because he didn't do a lot of those things, and yet he succeeded. So maybe there was a bubble in that particular industry. So that's an interesting related episode to listen to. Linked at TomWoods.com/1566. Jeff, we'll see you tomorrow for one last episode.
Okay, thanks.
All right, folks, if you enjoy and appreciate what I'm doing over here, do please join me as a supporting listener over at supportinglisteners.com. You get so many goodies, you're going to be like a kid in a candy store. Membership in my special group, the Tom Woods Show Elite, is but the icing on the cake of all the benefits you get, not to mention warming my heart. And isn't that also a benefit? So check that out, please, at supportinglisteners.com, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.